welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. This is episode 254, and guess who we got here? In the nick of time, John Lindemann.
In the flesh.
We've used that joke before. It's been about a month since we had you on here, John, so...
I've definitely missed the podcast, I must say.
I've been shaking with withdrawal. So I'm glad you're here to give me a hit of that silky sexy love. Spit your game, son!
A greeny green. You know what I mean?
No, spit it. Go.
Yo, it's Johnny L. I'm back from hell. On RFN, that's where I dwell. I'm here to talk games. I don't deal with lames.
Next
I talk to the ladies but don't remember the names. What? A little bit off the dome. You know what I mean?
Like all right, hair. Thanks everybody for listening to Radio Free Nintendo. We'll see you next week.
Actually now, Rap Free Nintendo. Officially going forward, because nobody wants to hear me do that ever again.
I do.
No, he was right. No one wants to hear that again.
Well, James definitely doesn't. James Jones is here, everybody.
This is my second irreverent opening of the day.
He's full of them. Got a bag. He's pulling them out one by one.
He's full of something.
Greg Leahy, also waiting in the wings.
Hello, everyone.
So, we have a podcast to do. John Lindemann, do it for us, please.
All of it.
It's the podcast, people.
You must have a lot of new business to go over.
Well, yeah, quite a bit. About 2 weeks of that was a lot of heavy work hours, which led to a lot of coming home and crashing instead of doing what I would like to do, which is gaming. But yeah, I got into a little bit of Contra 4. That's something that I kind of, you know, as you may know, I have quite an extensive backlog. I don't know if I've mentioned that on the show before, but...
Never heard of it.
I've just, been picking stuff off here and there. Contra 4, yeah. I probably mentioned this way, way back in the day, but this is, you know, one of those games notoriously that, you know, I bought it, played it for about a minute, and then put it back on the shelf, and I said, hey, I'll go to the next game. But yeah, so I actually decided to, I was kind of in a mood, you know, to kind of...
Get pissed off?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll get to that.
What rage?
Some kind of like, some sort of brainless arcade action, right? And Contra is perfect for that. So I've actually gotten kind of deeper into the game. I didn't even bother with anything but easy, because, I mean, even on easy, I get my face punched in on it, so...
Yeah, me too.
But, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it really does capture the whole Contra feel, because kind of like I got into this sort of because, you know, we've been talking about Contra 3 a lot on, you know, Super NES, and I kind of had that Contra yearning that I have every once in a while.
Whoa.
He starts to just hoard cigarettes and, like, knives and things like
that.
Yeah,
you know, I start to, you know, work out.
I need Contra.
You start a new steroid cycle?
Wear the old wife beater... Get a big gun, put on a...
This is getting a little too...
Specific, is that what you're saying?
Go out and hunt aliens.
Yeah, all the time. But yeah, I really like the actual running and gunning parts, the kind of the 3D tunnel parts. I can see how they put those in there because they kind of wanted to, you know, take it back to... I don't know, were they in Contra 3? I can't even remember.
Contra 3, like Super Contra or Super C, as it got shortened to because of the Iran-Contra situation.
Yeah.
Super C and 3 had overhead ones.
Yeah.
It was the original Contra, like, in the arcades, and then obviously they kind of had to do a slightly balked version of it for the NES and stuff. They had the 3D levels, the tunnel bits.
Yeah, the problem with them in Contra 4 is that they're often very, very short. So you'll sit there and you'll play through the normal, you know, vertical and horizontally scrolling areas for quite a span of time, and then you'll kind of be thrown into the tunnel areas, and they're very, very brief. Usually not quite as challenging, and they kind of break up the pace of the game in a strange way.
Yeah, I think that's what they're there for. And whether that suits you or not is another thing. You know, I think some people probably might be grateful for the break. But in a way, that's something I liked with Contra Rebirth, is that it's a short game, obviously. And I wouldn't necessarily say it's the best Contra game, but it is kind of all killer, no filler from the point of view. It's just 5 side-scrolling stages. That's kind of what you want from Contra, and that's all you get.
Yeah, because I think the tunnel areas are pretty much the least interesting part of the game. So I think that's kind of a wise choice. If you're going to dump something, just dump those, because the run and gun areas are so good, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's easy. I don't think you even get to play all the levels. But with normal, I think there's 9 stages, 3 of which are tunnel ones. I think that's how they're spread out.
Yep.
When you're playing through all of the stages, they are quite long. I assume it would be quite exhausting if you just played through the 6 side-scrolling stages all in a row. So that's probably the logic.
Yeah, I mean, you really, that's one of the things. I mean, the game really demands that you kind of be on. You know, you really have to sit there and, you know, kind of get into the zone, because, and that's why it's, what the one thing I do like is that if you just turn it off, and there are some times when I'm just kind of like, screw this, I'm just sick of this, and I turn it off. What'll happen is when you turn the game back on, you're like, hey, you're not done your game yet, because you haven't exhausted all of your, you know, your free lives or your continues. And it'll say, hey, you're not done the game that you had in progress. And you're like, all right, which is kind of cool, because, you know, there's honestly sometimes with this game, I just wanted to toss my DS out the window, because it's just so frustrating. And there's so much cheap stuff that happens. And it relies on some mechanics that really aren't as easy to pull off given the control scheme as you could, like some jumping areas, some areas where you have to grab onto stuff. It's just really, really annoying. But overall, yeah, I mean, it's really good. I think the bosses kind of vary. Some of them are very big and kind of crazy and takes you a while to beat them. Some of them are just very kind of boring and very simple to the point where you're just like, what, that's it?
Are you, John, are you interested in Contra Rebirth? Have you ever played it?
I haven't played it, but actually I am probably going to try it out. If it's kind of all killer, no filler, that definitely interests me.
I'm really curious to find out what they're going to do with Contra 3D. Because that was announced last E3, like last year, I think.
Yeah, well, I'm curious to know whether it still exists. I mean, the way things have gone.
I hope so. I mean, I think they could do some really cool stuff. I mean, in Contra 3, you have areas where, you know, you're getting fired at from the background, you know, getting...
The famous boss, you know, the skeleton boss that rips through the walls and breathes fire at you and all that. Yeah, I mean, there's loads of that stuff.
Yeah, isn't there actually a plane that comes from the background and shoots at you?
Yeah, it's one of the first, it's in the first level. Like, yeah, there's loads of that kind of stuff in 3 that would come over very nicely.
Yeah, I mean, do we know if Contra 3D is going to be a remake of Contra 3?
We don't know anything about it.
That's
we
the thing.
That it was announced at some point.
I don't know, maybe it's the sort of thing we might hear something about TGS. I don't know. I'm kind of hoping that the Japanese third parties have something to say about 3DS games at TGS, because not much of anyone had much to say about it at E3.
Yeah.
It's very true.
And also, just the other night, I picked up Final Fantasy III, of course, one of my favorite all-time games.
Hell yeah. High five, bro.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, Billy's never played it.
And he has also never played Chrono Trigger. I was reading that, right?
You're reading that?
No, I haven't listened to it yet. I listened to the one before that. But yeah, I saw that in the notes.
You're way ahead of Billy.
I saw that in the notes, and I was like, "What? What? Everybody gives me shit for years, and I've now beaten both of those games." So
I think it's the scale of the backlog that's the issue.
I guess so.
Not the content.
But he's cutting into it though. I mean, he's doing what you're supposed to do.
So yeah, you know, I absolutely love it. I mean, I would put it up there with, I think at one time my all-time, probably top three, was like that, Super Metroid, and...
The Last Ninja 2.
Super Mario RPG was up there, of course, Last Ninja 2. I can't actually say that without getting completely interrupted several times. This is not the same effect, but... So, you know, I played very little of this. I put maybe an hour into it. Got to the point where, like, you get to the cave that goes to...
South Figaro.
South Figaro, yeah, and it says that there's construction. And that was a point where I stopped. But I was thinking, one of the things I really like about it, and I think probably one of the things that drew me in when I first started to play it, is it's very fast-paced. The battles are very fast, and also the story moves around. There's a whole bunch of characters, but, you know, it moves around between them very briskly. So there's kind of always something going on. There's always something to keep you engaged, whereas in other RPGs, you kind of have these lulls between stuff happening where you're kind of like wandering.
Well, the other thing is, a lot of RPGs start out with the, you know, the traditional hero myth of you're this kind of small town kid. You're like Link in Twilight Princess. You know,
yeah.
You're some bumpkin. You know, you do some small task and a larger, you know, world ending thing is revealed to you or something, or at least someone tells you about it. And then you have to go on this long protracted quest to become powerful and become capable of saving the world. And in Final Fantasy III, I think the stakes are very high right from the very beginning, and also the characters that you're working with are pretty well established in their personalities. You know, they're written as characters, not as avatars for the player. I mean, and it's really reinforced by the fact that your main character is a female, which was pretty strange at that, you know, in that era. Really, even now, it's probably, you know, fairly unusual to have a big marquee title like that. I mean, they did it again in 13.
Yeah.
But,
and she's actually feared, too. She's a very powerful character.
Yeah, but also very confused. I mean, and she does have amnesia, which is a trope of, you know, Japanese storytelling, but she clearly has a history, and she's not just a blank canvas, you know, mm-hmm. and you're not just starting from some generic character from the very beginning. A lot of things are in motion from the very beginning. I mean, within a couple of hours, you're hearing about evil empires and rebellious factions and secret underground networks and, you know, kings and their brothers and lots of history with all these characters. And it mixes all that stuff in really early, whereas in a lot of other Final Fantasies, that stuff comes in way late.
I mean, there's something to be said about pushing that in gradually versus just being like, hey guys, guess what?
I've said it when I played it. I think it was just the sort of original Star Wars kind of approach rather than like the Lord of the Rings kind of approach, which you would ascribe to Twilight Princess. So I think it's just like, look, you know, you're in the middle of stuff. Stuff's happening. You'll pick it up as you go along. Mm-hmm. You know, even down to the tech scroll before everything kicks off. It's very Star Wars.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. Like, I mean, you get the sense that you're getting dropped into a world where stuff is already going on and you don't really see that too much. Like, usually you provide your character's background, you provide kind of the epic arc of the story, but you kind of get dropped in and there's stuff already happening. Stuff has happened, you know. There was a war, you know, all this kind of stuff that, you know, that affects the events of the present. But yep, fantastic. So I'm looking forward to playing through that because I don't think I've played through that since, I think I only beat it once, and that was, I think I beat it back in like 95.
One, I got a pro tip for you, John, and for anybody else who may be playing it on Virtual Console now or maybe thinking about it. The game does tell you this if you go in the training house in Narsh at the beginning, but there's like 20 guys in there and you might miss it.
Yeah.
It's very, very important that you know that you can push the shoulder buttons to spread a magic spell across the whole party or across all the enemies. So if you're using Cure, you can cure the whole party in one shot. With reduced, I mean, it'll spread out the effects, and you, no one person gets as much as if you just use it on a single target. Mm-hmm. But that is a lifesaver. It's really important. And the game only really tells you in one very specific place at the beginning of the game that's completely optional and easily missed.
Yeah. The one other thing I will say is I thought it was interesting how early they introduce the puzzle-type boss mechanics, where you fight this big snail right at the start, and it says, you know, you can't hit him with like your bolt attack because it'll, I mean, pretty much like you kill the front part of it and then you have to kill the back part of it, but eventually it runs out of MP and then you can just hammer it until it's dead. But you can't hit it with the bolt attack or else it'll regain its MP. So I thought that was very interesting where like right off the bat, the first boss that you face, it's not just some guy that you walk up to and, you know, you hit 20 times and he dies. Very interesting. You know, they kind of like throw that at you. Like, you know, like Greg said, they kind of do throw you into the game and, you know, just kind of figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say overall the game, the combat, the boss battles are a lot easier than Final Fantasy IV. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about the hard type, the Japanese version of FF4, like the DS one.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah.
The original American version is pretty easy, but that's, you know, that's the easy type. But FF3 is easier overall, but there are a number of bosses that either can be or must be defeated in unusual ways. Some of them will use extremely strong magic against you, and you have to use a character special ability to absorb it at the right time.
Yeah.
There's one much later in the game that has, as you kill it, it casts a spell that kills your entire party simultaneously. So you have to have a way to prepare for that, because it will happen every time. But there's a way to survive that. There are bosses you can kill in one hit if you know how to do it. If you just do something special, and you could defeat it the normal way, but it's a whole lot easier if you know the trick. And the trick is logical. I mean, it works within the rules of the game. So if you just think about it for a while, you could actually figure that out.
Okay, and the other game, once again, something taking it off the backlog, Mass Effect, which this one...
The original.
The original Mass Effect.
Yes.
This is one of my Hall of Shame games because...
Mass Effect Uno.
Yes. This is in the Hall of Shame. This was the one where, literally, I bought it on launch day.
Yes.
I put it into my 360, and I played it for 2 hours, put it on the shelf, and didn't put it into my Xbox again for 2 years. So, literally, I come back 2 years after the fact, after its launch day, I look at my saved game, and there's 2 hours on it. That's it. Never picked it up again.
That's awful.
And that was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So then you didn't play it again for another 2 years.
Yeah. I didn't play it again for like the longest time. So I'm like, okay, that's it. This will not stand. So So I just started completely over.
Well, you lost all that progress?
I know, it was heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking, you know, I had to think about it. But yeah, so, you know, I just said, I'm going to start all over here. And it's actually interesting because I said, I'm going to be bound and determined to actually kind of get into this game because part of the reason why I dropped this, also, you know, aside from the fact that I have complete game ADD, is just the fact that at the time, I didn't really feel like I wanted to make the sort of time investment that I felt would make it worthwhile to play through Mass Effect.
It's not that bad, though. That game's like 25 hours long.
I guess maybe up front, it seems like it's more than that just because, you know, they throw all the journal entries and codex stuff at you. And
oh, yeah.
You kind of feel like you should, like, read through it. Like, that's kind of what I ran into. I kind of ran into this wall where I was like, holy shit. Do I really want to get involved in a game that's this big and this involved and this massive in scope right now?
The interesting thing about Mass Effect is the world is really big in terms of the background, the story, the depth of the narrative and all the characters and the races, and the lore is expansive. The actual game's pretty narrow and not that long. And what I would tell you about, because it is easy to be intimidated by all the information that's available to you, mm-hmm. keep in mind it's all optional. And what I would recommend is that if you don't feel compelled to just jump into it and start reading and listening to all that stuff, don't, and wait, because later in the game, you'll probably actually want to.
Yeah.
So just let it come naturally.
Yeah, so it's not like there's going to be a pop quiz, like...
No.
There is the bit where you play the board game at the... Oh, that was Banjo-Kazooie, sorry.
But yeah, so, you know, I've kind of, you know, been playing that, put a couple hours into it. I'm looking to break the 2-hour threshold.
He's going to get the 4 and put it on the shelf. It'll be good.
Yeah. I'm going for my high score, so to speak. But
nice.
You set a new PR.
it's been interesting playing through it because, you know, it really is sort of a hybrid game. Like, especially like after kind of playing through these JRPGs, it's interesting kind of thinking of it because it's so easy for me to play that game and think or play it like just any third-person shooter because, I mean, that's how it plays. But I found myself kind of having to, like, stop for a minute and think, like, okay, the battle that I'm fighting is actually kind of the equivalent of your typical, like, JRPG battle.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. Like, it's kind of like you have to kind of change your whole thought process.
And you know you can pause it at any time and start and, like, assign the magic spells of your allies.
I did not know that.
You may not have gotten to that part of the game yet, but once you have like a team of 3 guys who go out in these big battles, you can actually control it almost like an RPG where you just pause it, make your decisions, tell them what to go do, and then unpause it and then take your shot.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I've not made it there yet. I just got to the Citadel. That's where I am right now.
Well, John, I'm glad you picked this back up again. This is, I think Mass Effect is actually the game in which I first learned of your Lindemann syndrome. Because this goes back way back on the podcast when you.
I think it was the most extreme example, except
it was when
for...
Mass Effect 2 came out that I think you actually brought this up.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily proud of it, I would say, but.
Why should you be?
Now, for the record, Mass Effect 2 is still sitting on the shelf.
I'm not proud that I hit that dog with the car, but just to be fair, he was kind of small.
But for the record, Mass Effect 2 has been opened. I did examine the contents. And I would like to say that I get through both Mass Effect 1 and Mass Effect 2 before Mass Effect 3 comes out.
Dude, that's a great goal.
That's my goal. That's my goal, people.
All right. Greg is up next.
Yep. So, as promised from last week, I'm going to talk about Mighty Milky Way. So this is WayForward's kind of final DSiWare adventure, I guess. So it came out, I think, in May. So a bit of an awkward slot from the point of view that it was kind of after the 3DS came out. So, you know, a lot of the media's attention was on the 3DS, even if it wasn't necessarily the most games coming out for it. But it was, of course, before the eShop launched. So it's not like you could actually play it on your 3DS yet when it came out. I think the timing was kind of a bit unfortunate in that regard. But it did get some good reviews, and I was interested in it, being a fan of a number of things that I've played of WayForwards, including the aforementioned Contra 4. So, to explain what it is, it's this sort of puzzle platformer kind of game where you play as this little alien girl called Luna, and she walks around these planetoids clockwise, always clockwise, and you start on a particular point in a sort of open level, and you just have to get to the exit gate. But the way that you traverse between these sort of empty spaces is you'll use the touchscreen, in fact, to sort of tap any given body, a little planetoid, that will spring her off that particular one and then onto another one, depending on gravity and things. And the whole game is kind of built around discrete increments. So first of all, you can affect how quickly she travels clockwise around a given planetoid with the D-pad. So you've got like three speeds and then just stationary, but you can't go backwards. And then you've also got, you can create planets for Luna to actually go to with the tap of the touchscreen. But there's three different sizes that you can make. So if you just tap it instantly, it'll create the smallest size. Hold it for a little longer, it's the medium. And then hold it for the longest, that creates the biggest size of planet. And of course, they have differing gravitational pull accordingly. And so these puzzle platform kind of elements, they're light to start with. There's like four worlds. Early on, it's pretty self-evident how you're going to do it. Sometimes the whole sort of planet creation aspect doesn't even necessarily come into it. You can only create planets if you have these sweets, the planet candies that you can pick up. At some levels, there aren't any. But as the game goes on, it layers in quite a lot of different elements that really contribute to things having to be figured out in a much more sort of significant way. So first of all, you've got, as I said, these candies. If they're in scarce amounts, you have to think about, you know, how do I manage them properly? You know, how am I going to be able to make this journey with only being able to create two planets? And then you get stuff like warp gates, where, you know, you'll appear in a completely different part of the level. You'll have walls that you can ricochet off, kind of dead zones where you can't create a planet. You get like cannons that are like the barrel cannons in DKC. You get like barriers to deal with, like that are made out of enemies that have to be destroyed by propelling an enemy into it. So you kind of have to think about how to transport an enemy from one planetoid to the next until it can burst through this barrier that you need to get past. So all these different elements in various combinations get layered on as the game goes on, and it becomes quite complex towards the end. The levels are usually quite small, and so even though, as I said, you know, because you only have this kind of limited control, you know, you can only go in a clockwise fashion, and you know, you're tapping to launch yourself from a planet, that obviously has quite a lot of potential to go wrong. And so you will die quite a lot, presumably, as you start to sort of initially try and figure out these levels. But because they're short, it's not that painful most of the time. You know, it's just like, well, you know, that didn't work. You know, it's not going to take you long to make up the kind of ground that you lost there. But I guess right towards the end, there's a few that are a bit longer and a bit more complex. But the fact that it's in these kind of discrete sizes of planets and these three speeds that you can travel at, it is possible to develop a very consistent and reliable sense of timing. You know, because it's all about angles at the end of the day. And once you get used to how each angle kind of works when you're, you know, traveling this fast around a planet of this size, you can be pretty dependable. Now, having said that, there are times, especially in the later levels, where you will be covering big distances, and that's where it can be pretty uncompromising. You know, like a degree, as it were, translates to a much larger variance in how close you are to the target if it's very far away.
Yeah.
And so it turns into, you know, real precision stuff towards the end. And again, because it kind of saves it for last, I guess that's fine. But again, I could imagine people would be quite frustrated. And the other thing about it, I think that's a little odd, is that, you know, especially like the default view is very zoomed in. You can zoom it out, but even then, you're not necessarily getting a big view of some of these levels, even if they're quite small. So what you're using a lot of the time is the second screen, which has a sort of map view of everything in the level. That's where you can kind of reason out, okay, well, if I go here, I'm going to have this many planets left to create, you know, can I do this? You know, you'll be looking at that a lot, reasoning out how to get to where you want to go. And also sometimes, even if you have to do some of these big kind of leaps of faith, you know, it's just something I've seen in reviews, people got to mention you have to make these leaps of faith. Well, they're not entirely kind of into the unknown, because you do have that screen there and you have a little icon that represents Luna walking around, and she has like a line sticking out. So it's actually quite easy to judge the angle, even from that very zoomed out view. Certainly between the two of you, so you get a pretty good idea of what you need to do at any time, but again, makes it very precise at times. So it's quite an unforgiving game in that way, but it's unique to the DS, you know, the fact that it's got these touchscreen, dual screen elements. It's challenging, it's thoughtful, and the aesthetic is quite nice. It's probably not one of WayForward's most visually impressive games. I mean, it looks nice enough, but it doesn't really emphasize that. You know, the way the levels are put together visually kind of reminds me more of something like Bangaio. That's sort of visually functional, and just so they can drop all these elements in. I mean, it's prettier than Bangaio, because Bangaio is not pretty at all. Mm-hmm. But you know what I mean, where they're more concerned with layout than they are with constructing something from a visual perspective.
It sounds like they have to be.
Yes, it very much so. It's got its heart in the right place.
So, Greg, do you think it's a good value?
With 40 levels, you know, I think you get, as I said, you've got all these different elements that come in and build up and layer on top of each other and get combined towards the end. I think there's a good variety there and there's a good challenge. I don't know whether it necessarily lasts you the longest time. I guess some of that would depend on how quickly you manage to overcome these things. I mean, I've got to the very end and the very final level is incredibly hard. It's a massive spike above anything else in the game. It's very tricky. I haven't done it yet. But there is also, apparently, kind of a cool unlockable mode in it, because what it does is once you beat it, the second mode basically turns everything into a time trial. And I think, in fact, that you have to keep moving because stuff starts blowing up. It's because it's called the time bomb mode or something. So that puts a different spin on it. You know, I mean, the one thing about this is you will get in situations where, you know, you can just kind of leave Luna walking around something. And it's like, if for any reason you're like, oh, I'm not sure, let me just wait for it to, okay, now this time I'm sure of the timing, bang. Well, you know, if you take that margin of error away where you can kind of wait and make sure you get it right, it's a lot harder, because that kind of happens a bit on the quote-unquote boss levels, where you get this bizarre cybernetically enhanced T-Rex blowing everything up with its eye laser.
Is that the secret boss in Disaster?
if they ever made a sequel, surely that would be a shoo-in. But if you're on a given planet in these boss type levels, when the T-Rex is sort of isn't already firing a laser, it'll target that planet and the crosshair will start flashing, and you've only got so long before it blows up. And so you have to keep moving. And that's what's different about the boss levels. But what it sounds like is once you complete the game, almost every level can become like that in this time trial mode. And so that's really challenging and could put a completely different spin on these levels. You know, they can be quite challenging in themselves, but if you put that constraint on everything that you've got to keep moving, you've got to get everything right the first time, essentially, that could add some significant replay value if you get into it. So, you know, it's an 800 point game. I think it's a pretty good value from the point of view that not so much about putting tons and tons and tons of hours into it, but because of how unique the experience is, because of the way the challenges are constructed nicely.
Yeah, I the reason I ask is because, you know, I have Shantae on DSiWare, on 3DS, and I think it's a good game. I don't like it as much as some of our other staff members do, but I do feel like it's maybe a little bit overpriced for what it is, because the Shantae is like a 3 or 4 hour game unless you get lost, and even then a lot of it's kind of, there's a lot of filler, there's a lot of backtracking where you're not really doing anything new that you didn't do the first time you went through there. And there's also a lot of the game being intentionally obtuse to sort of send you down the wrong path for you to go down there and realize, oh, this isn't, I couldn't do what I thought I could do here. Let me go back and try something different. And it's, sure. I think it's kind of doing that on purpose to make the game feel longer than it really is. It's just not that actual, there's a lot of great artwork in Shantae. There's not a lot of great content. There's some great content, and it's kind of spaced all out at the ends of the world. And there's a long stretch of travel that you have to do to get to it. So that's the reason I asked. But I mean, obviously it's a different kind of game.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as I said, it's, you know, much less sort of concerned with that. It is very much just these are levels that are presented to you very specifically. Mm-hmm. That's all there is. You know, there's no kind of pretense of anything more than that.
Yeah. The other thing to note is that you said this is the last DSiWare game for WayForward, and that's because they are moving on to 3DS. And
yes.
And their first eShop game is the first, in other words, their first so-called 3DS ware is going to be called Mighty Switch Force, And I don't know much about how it plays, but I saw some video of it, and it's still 2D sprite artwork, very pretty.
On a 3D handheld.
Yeah, well, it'll have some kind of 3D parallax.
2D images of a 2D game in 3D.
No, there will be, there will be some parallax effect, I'm sure, with the 3D. But it looked really nice, and it looked, again, kind of puzzle platformy type stuff.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be kind of a run and gun, you know, a bit Contra-ish, but then with some puzzle kind of elements as well. So could be interesting, that one. I'm definitely enthused about that.
Could be very cool.
Okie doke. So I'll go next, and I've played a couple of Xbox Live Arcade games. Sorry, people. But I think these will be of interest to our audience. And these are both games that, they're both recent games, and they were both described to me before I played them, before I bought them, as being sort of Metroidvania style games. And for one of them, that's true, and for the other, it's not. So I'll start with Outland, because this came out in May, I want to say, May or June.
It was May's big game.
I think it was only $10. Like, it seemed like a really good value, and I would actually say it is a very good value at $10. It's a fairly large game. There's quite a bit to it. It's a 2D platformer where you have the ability to switch your character between red and blue, which looks a lot like Ikaruga, and in fact, it is very much inspired by Ikaruga.
Cribbed, as it were.
Cribbed, yeah. It's sampled from Ikaruga, and you play through this big silhouetted world. It's very pretty. The artwork is really, really spectacular, and the animation's good.
This was done by Housemarque, right?
That's right.
Who also did Super Stardust HD and Dead Nation.
I played the demo for Dead Nation, did not care for it at all, and I'm not real crazy about Super Stardust either. I got that one for free with the welcome back.
Yeah.
I don't really like it much.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of both those games. So.
Okay.
Yeah. Fine.
Yeah, I agree. Do it.
Outland is definitely a big departure for them because those other two are both twin stick shooters, and this is in no way there's no shooting, there's no twin stick. It is a 2D platformer, action platformer. And I can see where you might get a feel that the way the character moves is reminiscent of maybe Samus or maybe Ninja Gaiden or a game like that where the character moves very fast, jumps really high from the very beginning of the game. And as you play through, you do gain new abilities, but these new abilities, a lot of them are combat based. It's just a new, more powerful attack, or now you can use your energy to shoot off this big blast ray that kills a bunch of stuff. But for the most part, these are only used to let you keep pushing forward and to give you new challenges. They're not meant to be taken back to earlier parts of the game to access new things. In fact, the game is really directed. It's not linear because you could technically go back to all the places that you've been before. And there are actually teleport portals all over the place that you can use to skip around. I haven't teleported once.
Which is not Metroidvania-like.
It's more, no, but it is Castlevania-like.
It's not Metroid-like. It is Metroidvania-like.
It is. Yeah. But I'm like 60-70% through the game, and I haven't teleported a single time. Because there's no reason to.
You're not going to get that achievement.
For teleporting?
There's got to be.
Maybe there's one for not teleporting.
A lot of those live arcade games really start to run out of things to give you achievements for.
Yeah. Anyway, Outland is really beautiful. It controls really well. The character has a nice feel to his movement. The combat is really fast-paced, and it also feels very good. And it's challenging. The game throws enemies at you in a way. The funny thing about it is, even though it's this 2D action platformer, it's also a bullet hell game. It's not a bullet hell shooter, but there are things all over the levels that just spray colored pellets, and you have to turn into the right color so you can pass through it like an Ikaruga.
It's basically a rave from death.
It's very colorful, and they're spraying all these crazy patterns, and you're trying to figure out how can you move through this safely. Sometimes they do that with platforming, so maybe there's a bunch of moving, floating platforms that you're trying to get across, and as you do this, you've got, you know, sprays of energy bullets all over the place, and you're switching colors in between, or the platform doesn't appear until you turn in the right color, so you're switching in midair to try to make this platform materialize below you, and those are really exciting. And then at other times, the game will throw a lot of enemies at you, while all this bullet hell stuff is going on. And that is really challenging and stressful because you're trying to focus on whittling away at these enemies while at the same time not taking damage from all the bullets coming through. And keep in mind, you have to be the correct color to even damage the enemies. So balancing those two things and trying to manage like the sequence that you defeat the enemies in or where you stand in order to do it is really important. And it's actually, I find it pretty difficult. And the game doesn't punish you very much if you die, thank goodness, because I've died many times playing this. It's surprisingly challenging. But yeah, it's really good. I mean, I would say the Metroidvania comparison is like the barest of similarities there. But in practice, you wouldn't want this to be really nonlinear and explorative because the game is sort of built around all these set pieces of you moving through crazy patterns of bullets.
Yeah.
And completing combat / platforming challenges. And once you do that, it feels really satisfying to get to the end of those. You don't want to do those again. You certainly don't want to go through it backwards, and you don't want to have to do it several times to keep going back to the same place. So the game is designed so that it does a good job of, you will go through, sometimes you'll go through the same areas more than once, but it'll take you on a completely different path. And the game always tells you where to go next, what direction to take at a fork in the road. There's a couple, you know, there's little hidden things if you go off the beaten path, but you don't need to. And the game almost never makes you go back through an area that you've been through before, which I think is a good thing in this case, because it really is more of a, you really want to be focused on the mechanics of actually getting through these challenges, not where do I go next or where do I use this ability now that I've got it. It doesn't really task you with that kind of a thing. Also has amazing bosses, like gigantic screen-filling, zoom the camera way the fuck out bosses.
Yeah, it sounds very Contra 4-ish because, I mean, even on easy, one of the things you really have to watch is just, you know, getting hit and dying cheaply from the random pellet that someone shoots across the screen at you.
It's not random, John. You're just not paying close enough attention.
All right, I guess, you know, it's just my fault.
It's a very important thing that you just have to kill things as quickly as possible so
exactly.
They don't get the chance to spew their little bullets.
I will agree.
And
random,
it makes
probably the wrong word. Probably I just should have used I fucking suck. Is that what you want me to say?
Have you tried sucking less every game of show?
Try sucking less. L2P, right? Yeah, but it sounds very similar to that. You have to manage the bullet hell a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not like Contra in that you fight with a sword and not a gun.
Yeah.
And that's why I compare it maybe a little bit more to...
Strider, it sounds like.
Strider, Ninja Gaiden, ActRaiser... Yeah. Feels a little bit like that.
Minus the good part.
So you have to get close to your foes, to your enemies.
Yes, that's right. You have to get close. It's a really good game. And as I said, it's longer than you might expect, actually. So I think there's a lot of content. It's really pretty. Good stuff. The story's stupid. The narration, stupid. But whatever. The other game I played, and this one is very much... like a Metroid game. Actually, not even so much like a Castlevania game. There's no RPG-type elements to it. It's a straight-up tribute to Metroid. It's called Insanely Twisted Shadow Planet. And it's also a great game if you're a fan of 2D hand-drawn artwork, because it has some of the best I've ever seen in any video game. I mean, this is lush and gorgeous, really well animated, amazing, just monsters. And I think that's why, other than the structure of the game is very Metroid-y, in the way that it guides you around all these caves and you're looking for power-ups and it's asking you to do sort of clever things sometimes with your abilities that you might not think of earlier. So it's really, really well designed, and that way it's a great tribute to Metroid, but also in the atmosphere of it, because you're on this alien planet, you don't belong there, you're trying to sort of get to the heart of it and defeat whatever's driving it. You've got all these alien creatures all over the place who sometimes will just leave you alone unless you mess with them. A lot of times they seem to be acting in self-defense more than anything. And they do regenerate if you come back a little bit later. So, you know, it's very much really, really, really feels like Metroid in so many ways. The soundtrack is probably a little bit too subdued. It's probably going a little bit too far on the atmospheric side or the ambient side for my taste, but the sound effects are wonderful and, again, remind me very much of Metroid in the way that Metroid's sound effects are almost more important than the soundtrack, especially mm-hmm. if you go back to, like, the first game. The sound effects in that first Metroid game are really iconic, and a lot of them are still used, even in the Metroid Prime series, they're still used. Mm-hmm. And this game, it feels like if they ever, you know, you could totally make sequels to this and use the same sound effects, because they're really iconic, they really fit what's going on here. But the idea is that instead of it being a platformer where you're running around and jumping and shooting, you control this UFO. So, in that sense, it as you play it, it can look a little bit like Pixel Junk Shooter, but that game's broken up in all these little bitty levels, you know, and it's very much about manipulating all these fluids. This is an exploration game, and it's a gigantic world, tons of like long tubes of caves that interconnect, and you're not really sure where they go next, and the big map that you pull out and look at where you're trying to go next. And the game gives you a vague idea of where to go next, but the levels are so the geometry of the world is so complicated. You don't really know how to get there. You can just kind of go in that general area and see what you find. You can find power-ups when you're not even looking for them sometimes. It's just really exciting stuff. I think it's extremely well done and just really fun to play, because flying around this UFO feels good. It has a certain amount of momentum to it, and it's easy. It's responsive to control. It's fast, but the enemies are fast too, so you really have to stay on the ball with it. And the upgrades that you get, a lot of them are really interesting and very fun to use. And you end up using them in ways that you might not expect when you first pick them up. This is a really impressive, very, very cool game.
Yeah, I mean, since you're a UFO, what kind of upgrades do they get? I mean,
thrusters. You get to upgrade your thrust.
Thrusting. I haven't seen a thruster upgrade. I wouldn't mind getting one to make it so that when you get on a straight line, you can move a little faster. That might be nice. But you get shield. You get like armor upgrades. That's like probably the least interesting one. But you have this whole tool thing. If you hold the shoulder button, you get this wheel of all your tools that you can pick from. Some of them are weapons. Some of them are just tools. Some of them are tools that you might be able to use as weapons in the right circumstances. But you have a little grappling thing that you can pick up rocks and move them around. And that's used in a lot of puzzles. You have a little scan, like satellite dish that you use to scan things and get information about how you might solve a puzzle or how you might defeat an enemy. You have a little pea shooter that also gets upgraded over time. That's your main weapon. But you get a buzzsaw that's really fun to use, and that can be a really powerful weapon, but also cuts through certain things in the environment, lets you get to different places. I just picked up the missile, which is really cool, and the way it works is that you don't actually aim this like the pea shooter. If you're using the main ray gun, it's kind of like a twin stick shooter, except it's not so much an action game, but you defeat some enemies. But once you get the missile, you don't actually aim it with the stick before you shoot it. You shoot it, and then your aiming stick actually lets you control the missile independently of the UFO. So you have complete control over it. So it's more like the user-controlled missile in Perfect Dark, for example.
Cool.
Yeah. And there's some very, very cool switch puzzles where you fire the missile into this little tunnel in the wall that your UFO won't fit through. So you fire a missile into it, and once it goes in that tunnel, the game zooms in and slows way down, and you have to try to guide the missile all the way through this tunnel without making it run into the walls and blow up before you get to the switch on the other end. So it's almost like this game's equivalent of the Morph Ball tunnel puzzles in Metroid Prime, and they're really fun and challenging. So it's a really cool game. Again, it's probably... I will probably like it more than almost anyone else, because it's almost made just for me, but you should at least try it out. I mean, for the artwork alone, it's definitely worth checking out, because it's really gorgeous.
Cool.
All right, James, wrap it up, please.
Yep, so unlike Greg, I did not fulfill the promise I made.
I'm lowering your credit rating, James.
I offered to play one of the three arcade games that I discussed in last week's episode, but there were no suggestions in the thread, so I didn't.
No one gives a shit what you play, James.
It's fine, I'll just sit here and talk about something else then. Instead, I actually went to Best Buy to procure a replacement for the netbook, but since I didn't have anything that I wanted, and I had money burning all in my pocket at this point, I perused the game section and found they were having a 2 for the price of 1.5 sale on Xbox and PS3 games, which they do these kind of unannounced sales every so often, but I took advantage of it to get two games I had wanted to play, and the one I'll talk about this week is Borderlands.
Nice.
Which, Johnny, you've played and spoken of.
I've played a shitload of Borderlands. It's really good.
So I think my first, I found the game was difficult to get into at the beginning because it felt like there was a lot of walking and not doing a whole hell of a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say the first 3 or 4 hours, you don't really feel like you're doing anything except finding this jackass some part that he's only 5 feet from and could have easily gotten off his ass to get himself. You know, I mean, one of your first missions is literally open a door. Now, I know why they do it, but it does feel kind of shitty. So you get a very large reward for opening the door, though, which is kind of odd. There's no key or anything. You just tell it to open. But the game, basically, if you are somehow unaware, you play I guess the term for it would be a rogue who is looking for this semi-mythical construct known as the Vault on this post-apocalyptic world that is infested with these weird gang members and these dog-like monsters. And you then begin exterminating weird gang members and dog-like monsters.
It's infested with a lot more than that as you get...
Those are the ones that you see very early on.
Mm-hmm.
And you see a lot of them. There's an endless stream of dog monsters. But what you spend a lot of the game doing is going to some place on the map, fetching some item, and then going to some other place on the map that may or not be where you started from. And in the process, you kill many, many things. I mean, in a nutshell, that is Borderlands. But a lot of the game is centered around the development of your character's statistics in the efficacy of their ability to kill, essentially. Mm-hmm. For me, I went with the sniper character and found that that is a disappointing choice that no one should ever make.
I don't think I used the sniper character. I did find sniper rifles later in the game that I thought were amazing, that I used a lot, but they're kind of few and far between.
Yeah.
And you don't have to use a sniper character to use a sniper rifle, so...
No. In fact, I have a sniper and have stopped using the sniper rifle except in the most minute situations.
Yeah, eventually you'll probably find a sniper rifle that kicks a hell of a lot of ass, and you will probably use it a lot.
Yeah, this is kind of where I run into an issue with this game in that there are a lot of weapon types, but it seems like some of them are particularly not useful or aren't useful in many instances.
Mm-hmm.
For the first 6 or 7 hours of the game, I almost exclusively use what they call the repeater, which is basically just a handgun.
Yeah.
Because early in the game, they start giving you these stupidly powerful handguns. I mean, they inflict a ton of damage and set shit on fire. They're also incredibly accurate, and no other gun in the game at that point is even remotely accurate.
Yeah, but and there's a lot of randomization in the kinds of guns that you get.
Yeah.
From enemies especially, but I would also say as you go through the game, you'll probably find that repeaters become less useful and the other guns become more useful.
Yeah, the enemies do drop, will occasionally drop something really good, but by and large, they drop things called like crappy rusted repeater. You're like, well, I don't want that. That doesn't sound good at all.
This was when I talked about Borderlands early in the year, that was one of my complaints, is that if the enemy's going to drop a gun that is way shitty compared to the stuff I've got, I'd prefer that it just didn't drop it. Because then I don't have to take the time to go look at it and decide whether or not to keep it. It was just to streamline everything. Like, if it's not clear whether or not it would be better than what I've got, then show it to me and let me make that decision. But if it's, like, strictly inferior to everything that I have equipped, just don't bother.
Yeah. I found that the guns that they drop, by and large, are really bad. And I actually, it's funny that John mentioned Mass Effect, because I go back to Johnny, your issue with the original Mass Effect was the enemies would drop stuff, and you're like, well, I don't really know if this is better or worse than what I have.
Yeah, you do. You spend a lot of time in Mass Effect just managing, like...
See, I wasn't bothered by it in that game, but in this game, I find myself utterly bothered because I'll have to go say, all right, is this better than the submachine gun I'm carrying? Mm-hmm. Well, it might be situationally better than the submachine gun I'm carrying because it's not completely and utterly inaccurate.
Right.
But it's still only marginally better than Ray Charles in a shooting gallery.
And Borderlands, and this is a problem with all loot games, and it's one reason that I don't love loot games as much as some people do. But I think it depends a lot on the interface. You know, how easy is it for you to make those decisions quickly without wasting a lot of time? In
right.
Mass Effect, it's particularly bad. In the first Mass Effect, it takes a long time to pull up all these menus and examine them and figure out. And it was a huge problem in Too Human, Huge problem. The interface
just
sucked.
That's a minor issue.
It just sucked to make those kinds of decisions. It buries the game in the tedium of jumping in and out through menus to compare weapons to see that, oh yeah, this totally sucks. I don't want it. But yeah, it took me 45 seconds to determine that when I could have been playing the game. And when that happens hundreds of times, it becomes a real problem. Borderlands does a much better job than those games. But still, because of the amount of loot in it, it's just not good enough for me.
So what it does differently is, if you're looking at a gun on the ground, it will tell you how its stats compare to the gun you're currently holding. Which, if you're holding the gun that it would ostensibly replace, that's fine. Or if it's in your equipped list of guns, which is up to 4, but I think you only start with 2. That's fine. You can just switch to it. But if it's not equipped, then you still have to go dig into the menu and equip it and then do the comparison.
Yeah. And I mean, and the problem is, right, the fact that you can sell those guns means that you want to pick that gun up, regardless of whether or not you need it, because it's good for you because you make money off of it.
Yes.
But the fact that they force you into this corner of, oh, well, we know you want to pick this gun up, but yeah, you really don't have any room for it. So you have to, you know, jump through a bunch of hoops and just pick it up.
There was a point where I was carrying around guns for the sake of selling them. I had my 6 firearms that I was using, and I had a few extra slots. And I was forced to actually go look at my extra weapons just to see which one was the least valuable and see if it was more monetarily valuable than the gun that was on the ground.
Right.
So it wasn't a stat-based conversion. It was straight-up cash. But for me, while I started to have more fun with it as things actually started to happen, I still get kind of annoyed with how the game does its sort of monster room style of combat, where there are places on the level that every time you go there, you are going to be attacked by the stupid dogs or by the gang members or any combination thereof, or the rocks, which are these big flying bastards, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Now, do you think those areas are put there so you can just sit there and grind them out?
No, because once you kill them, they're gone until you leave and come back. Like, this cave will spawn 3 of these monsters, and there's, like, 4 caves.
But, John, I think you're right to some extent, that you can grind in this game, because you're gaining experience as you do all this, and you're maybe gaining better weapons, I mean, over time. But, I mean, the interesting thing is, James, and I don't know if you're far enough to really feel this effect yet, but as you get farther in the game, and your character levels up a lot, and you gain new skills, new abilities, much better guns, different kinds of guns than you had before, going through those parts becomes almost like a joke.
Yeah, I know.
It's interesting to find, like, places that were really hard earlier are now really easy for you to get through.
And I'm at that point because I'm at level, like, 16.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the main area of the Badlands, I can just basically, like, one bullet takes down the biggest of the dog monsters.
Yeah.
But I still have to kill them, because while I'm trying to snipe this gang member, I'm being bitten the leg by this fucker. So a lot of times I just turn around and melee him in the head and kill him.
That works.
It does work. Actually, the melee in this game might be a little overpowered. But what isn't overpowered, and this is what was getting on my nerves really, really badly yesterday when I finally gave up on it, was in one of these mission-based monster rooms. It was just full of the gang members, like a ton of them. And one of them is the steroid freak guy. I can't remember what they're called, but you see a bunch of them. And he was 2 levels higher than me, and I was hitting him directly with a rocket launcher and finding it was doing almost no damage.
Wow.
I've noticed, though, that the rocket launchers themselves, at least the early ones, kind of suck.
Oh, no, you're right. They suck all the way through the game. Totally. They're really inaccurate, and probably the reason that you weren't doing damage to him, because it wasn't hitting him. It looks like it hits him, but it doesn't.
So the boss right before him, which is this big, burly thing that is huge and terrifying, the rockets actually went right through him. I had to hit the floor in front of him, and only to find they don't do any goddamn damage.
They don't do any splash. Yeah, the rocket launchers are all broken. Don't use them. I kept thinking, oh, this is the one. I mean, at one point I had a rocket launcher that shot 3 at the same time. They sort of spiraled into the enemy, and I thought, well, if this doesn't kill it, nothing will. And it was always the worst of the 4 weapons I was carrying. So I just stopped taking them at all after a
while. It doesn't make sense, because one of the vehicles, a rocket cart, which, by the way, this game needed vehicles way sooner than you get them, and that driving is kind of fucked.
It's crazy.
The rocket launcher on the vehicle is like the Grim Reaper. I mean,
it's God mode. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the rocket launcher in the game is shit. It doesn't make any sense. But what I found was that particular boss battle, the only way I could beat him, because he did some ridiculous amount of damage, was the utterly broken mechanism of killing every enemy in the monster room he resides, then standing on the other side of this pit and just shooting him until I ran out of ammo, walking back to the vending machine, buying more ammo, and then coming back and shooting him some more.
It sounds like you needed to level up a little bit more.
It's called immersion, people.
The only way I could lose was literally to run out of money.
I feel like you're right in the world.
Sounds like you were underleveled for that boss.
I was four levels lower than him, but 16 sniper rounds to the head should kill anything, regardless of your level.
In the heat of battle. All right, hold on one second. Hold on. Hold that thought.
I gotta go buy some more ammo.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how they address things like that, because I mean that. I didn't have that exact experience, but I definitely found bosses that were more attrition than skill.
Yeah.
And now that Borderlands 2 was just announced, I mean, Borderlands has many faults. It's a messy game. It's so expansive that it's no surprise that it's messy.
Yeah.
It's like a GTA level of breadth for a video game.
See, that's a comparison I don't like about this game though, because it's GTA, but the majority of it is empty.
Hmm.
There's big stretch, like there's a highway in the Badlands area that you can drive from one end to the other,
mm-hmm.
and there's nothing on it. It's just emptiness. So if your car blew up, well, guess what? You're hoofing it
right.
A long freaking way.
That sucks.
And doing nothing.
Ugh.
I feel like the overworld needed something else going on besides the occasional stumbling across a cave full of the dog monsters and going, damn it, again? I mean, I'm only about, I don't know, a handful of hours in, and I've already got the achievement for killing 250 of those bastards.
I mean, Borderlands is, like, weirdly addictive, and I think it's the feedback loop of using your game video game skills to shoot a guy and actually get experience for it that over
right.
time makes you better at shooting guys.
I wish the sniper rifle especially, because I really wanted to use that. You know, like go way out long distance and just start blasting dudes. I really do feel like there should be a little bit more play in the weapons, because if mm-hmm. I'm in a gun duel with the guy from 2,000 meters and he's got a submachine gun and I have a sniper rifle, I should never lose that engagement.
Right.
And yet in Borderlands, you will.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the game has, there's a lot of room for improvement in the sequel, and I'm super excited because, again, the amazing thing is, although I could spend half an hour going through all the flaws of Borderlands, I love it. It's amazingly addictive and really, really fun and exciting to play. So I think you start cleaning up that stuff and you've got a really epic, amazing game on your hands.
So, I mean, obviously, I'm not going to be able to devote a lot of time to that game because I have Enslaved to play, which is the other game I bought.
Ooh, Enslaved is good. It's short, though.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. Compared to Borderlands, it's insignificant.
Well, considering I only paid, if you take into account the half price, like $8 for it, I don't feel
nice.
So bad.
Oh, it's a great game.
So, Ninja Theory, giving you your chance.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
All right, well, that is new business. So now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with our ongoing feature for the 20th anniversary of Super Nintendo, the SNES 20, where every day we take a look back at one of the Super Nintendo's most important and outstanding games. We've already covered such brilliant titles as A Link to the Past, Contra 3, Street Fighter 2 Turbo, and we're going to cover many more as we go sort of roughly in chronological order through 20 of the Super Nintendo's best games.
We also have a review of Pac-Man and Galaga Dimensions for the 3DS. It is the Namco compilation of what is essentially four games, I guess is how they bill it, or six, depending on how you want to list it. And we also have impressions from Kirby's Mass Attack, the game where you play as a bunch of Kirbys in a mob.
All right, and we also have an Extra Life feature from James Dawson on Chippendale Rescue Rangers. And I will note that in our script here, Johnny spelled Chippendale as Chippendale, Chippendale's like the male review.
Johnny, where's your head at?
Perhaps a Freudian slip there on the part of our fearless leader, Mr. Metz. But yes, talking about the classic NES game, Chippendale Rescue Rangers. And also from Zach Miller, speaking of keeping our sexual theme going.
No!
We have the indefensible position, an editorial speaking upon the evolving, I guess you could say, size of the breasts of Miss Lara Croft. If you're interested in that sort of thing, yeah, check it out.
So we have all that and all the latest reviews, news, and previews at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to RFN. Unfortunately, Johnny had some family commitments and couldn't join us for the second segment of the show, but it must go on, of course, and we have all of your listener mail to get to. So if you'd like to send your letter in to RFN, you can reach us at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And with that, we're going to crack on. So, John, you have the first letter.
All right, Jay from Tampa writes, I loved hearing your thoughts on new Smash Brothers characters. I would definitely like to see characters that were in the show Captain N appear in the next game, including Captain N, which I don't know if that is even possible since he is technically not a video game character. Having Simon, Mega Man, and King Hippo would be amazing. I wonder if Nintendo owns the rights to Captain N, and wonder, what do you guys think a Captain N game would be like? He has a zapper, so there could be some shooting elements. I could see it using the engine from Metroid Other M. The licensing of all the necessary characters would probably make the game impossible to happen. It would be like the end of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, where you have characters from all animation backgrounds coming together. Seems like, unfortunately, that show was the closest we could ever get.
Yeah, I don't see them pulling out Captain N from the vaults for anything in actuality. I mean, I assume they're completely oblivious to it in Japan. First of all, you know, where all these decisions would get made about, you know, Smash Brothers or a separate game. Yeah. You know, that just doesn't matter to them.
Yeah. So, for reference, the Captain N character, or the Captain N series, is the property of Deke Entertainment.
Yeah, they made all those cartoons for that, so like Zelda and the Super Mario as well.
I believe the Captain N character might belong to Deke, as it were, but they probably can't use it without Nintendo because they own all the elements of it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of one of those weird hybridized where somebody owns the rights to part of it but not all of it. And we actually ran into this on the Virtual Console with some games where like the rights are a bit ambiguous.
Or in some cases, there's some sort of pretty naked kind of copyright infringement that was overlooked at the time, because I guess it was just more Wild Westy, like those Shinobi games where he's fighting Spider-Man, basically.
Yeah.
They kind of got away with that, and then he couldn't get away with it.
It's a difficult situation, because he technically was originally known as Captain Nintendo.
Yeah, it does obviously seem like a non-starter to bring that back. I mean, my memories of it are pretty vague, to say the least. In fact, the most abiding memory that I have is just of that, why is Simon Belmont a narcissist? I never got that from the Castlevania, where he's just bravely thrusting himself onto the nearest insta-death spike he could find.
Well, the spikes are reflective, that's why.
Well, possibly. This drives this vain, selfish guy. I mean, any of you two guys have got a better memory of it?
No, I think it was a little bit after my time.
I remember thinking, this is the dumbest show I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, I think I just kind of dismissed all of those Nintendo cartoons. They were pretty terrible.
I could tolerate the Mario one because I recognize that it was dumb, but like enjoyably dumb. The Zelda ones I have very little memory of, except
I've never seen any of the Zelda. I don't know whether that ever made it to British TV. Maybe Zelda wasn't as big as you know, the other stuff. But
excuse me, ratings.
Yeah, the whole excuse me thing, that meme, was completely news to me. I only really learned of it online, you know, years later.
I remember thinking that Captain N was just dumb. Like irredeemably, pointlessly, unwatchably dumb. Mind you, I was 4.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was a similar age when I would have seen, you know, things seemed off to me. Like, I'd never played Metroid. I just read about it in, you know, like Club Nintendo magazines or whatever. But it's just like the whole way they had Mother Brain being this sort of shrill, female character just seemed like, no, that's not what they're getting at with Mother Brain. You know?
Yeah, that was the one where she spoke with this like, wah, kind of voice, right?
Yeah.
And just looked ridiculous as I recall.
Didn't Mother Brain have like lipstick too? Or something? It was
really, yes. Yeah, yeah. She did have
it
lipstick.
Wasn't. It wasn't just the lack of concern for the franchises, because I didn't care. I was four. It was more that the show was just dumb compared to other things that were on. I mean, 80s cartoons are irredeemably bad across the board. Like anyone who thinks, "Well, that was a good show back then," no, you're blinded by nostalgia. 80s cartoons were really bad. Because they were made to sell toys.
Yeah, even the ones that were supposedly really good, like G.I. Joe and like, you know.
They're bad. If you go watch them now, you'll think, well, this is fucking terrible. But Captain N was a special kind of bad. It was the GoBots to the non-existent Transformers of the video game world.
Yeah, it definitely had the B-team, like the guys that couldn't get hired by like something else that was actually really popular.
So, I mean, I don't think there's much chance of a revival of that in any form. But of course, you know, it was at the time, the whole concept was, you know, mashing all these Nintendo characters together, which at that point, actually, as I saw how we got onto this from last week, included guys like Mega Man and Simon Belmont, because they were so inextricably linked with the NES. And that's the thing. I mean, Smash Brothers is just sort of really an alternate way of doing the same thing that's just way better, because it's a fun game.
Right. And its silliness is okay. I mean...
Yeah, exactly. Because they sometimes they sort of attempt this sort of weird pseudo story. You know, the last one you had the
Subspace Emissary.
I mean, some of those cutscenes are just worth it for just because they're so crazy. You know, like Ridley smashing Samus up against a wall, and then Pikachu comes in and saves her. Like, it's so demented.
It's the silent acknowledgement of thank you for saving me. That in that scene, that really did it to me. I was.
I mean, there's some hilarious sort of like team ups. You know, like there or like Snake with the two princesses, or you know, I mean. That's what's kind of fun about it, but definitely not to be taken too seriously. So I don't think they're gonna ever go too far beyond that. I mean, it's possible they might actually rein it back if, you know, some of what they sort of suggested about having more one-player content sort of on the portable side comes to fruition.
I want a story all about Pikachu, Zelda, and Jigglypuff love triangle. That's all I want. Get on that.
It's terrifying.
People just turned off the podcast. It's over.
I have the next email here. This one is from Shaman in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. And he writes, I was inspired to write after hearing Greg's impressions of Super Mario 3D Land from episode 252, and I had to ask a simple question. Why does Nintendo seem to hate what makes them the most money? Simple 2D Mario. Although Mario Galaxy 2 was my Wii game of the year last year over the likes of Epic Yarn and DKC Returns, I still prefer the 2D Mario games, and apparently a lot of people do as well. New Super Mario Bros. Wii has sold nearly 21 million copies worldwide, which is 50% more than both Galaxy games combined, 14 million, and the DS version is pushing 27 million. And just a quick side note here, I think it did manage to crack the top 10 of the MPDs just this month.
Jesus.
Fucking shit,
the
man.
DS game is still. I think that's a case of the market coming back to it. Yeah. You know, it's been simmering along at the same level, and it was a down month. So, yeah, point well taken. Even the 25th anniversary ROM dump cleared a million worldwide and earned a second printing that wasn't guaranteed previously. Yet, the DS New Super Mario Bros. Game was the first traditional Mario platformer since the Super NES. Is it a coincidence that the two systems that never had a 2D Mario, the N64 and the GameCube, failed to set the world on fire?
Yes.
I understand that putting a 2D Mario on 3DS might be slightly against the point, but if they had announced, say, New Super Mario Bros. 3 for the 3DS at the time of the price cut announcement, I dare say they could have gotten away with a $200 price point for the 3DS. Where does the RFN crew stand on this?
Mario, New Super Mario Brothers, Wii and DS both came out after the systems became successes.
Yes.
They are not relevant to the success of those hardwares.
With the Wii, a long time after. I mean, holiday 2009.
It was on the downslope at that point.
I mean, it had a massive holiday that year.
It did, but that was the apex. I mean, that was...
It definitely helped keep it going, the level of sales for longer than seemingly it might otherwise
have
done.
But there's no connection between the dearth of 2D Mario games on those two systems and the lack of success for those systems. Those systems failed because the N64 had a cartridge-based format that developers didn't like, mm-hmm. and the GameCube failed because it was the fucking GameCube.
very deep analytical.
I think you can't really remove these games, you know, in terms of the N64 and GameCube. You can't remove those games from kind of the climate in which they were made. I mean, you were not, it would not, like, a 2D Mario game would not have happened in the days of the N64 because that was when
it would have been completely antithetical.
Absolutely. It would have looked like, it would have been completely seen as ass backwards, stuck in the past.
Well, and it would have gone against what Nintendo was doing. I mean, Nintendo was the first of the major hardware manufacturers to say, this is a 3D generation of gaming systems. Yep. Our controller should reflect that.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, there's a number of levels to look at it. If you just going back to that, let's just say the breaking point, you know, obviously, you know, Super Mario World sort of launched the Super NES and all that. So then when you come to the N64, instead we have Super Mario 64. Now, it was really essential to show, you know, what was special about the
right.
N64, you know, its controller in particular, 3D environments, 3D graphics, 3D movement.
All of which was still very, very new at the time. I mean, it was so new, they felt they had to give you an avatar for the camera.
Yeah, that it was Lakitu and all that.
Yeah, I mean, because people didn't get the concept of there's a camera around you in 3D space, so they actually put a fucking camera in the game.
I mean, I think it's perfectly understandable that they wanted to create something that would show off why they made all the decisions they made with the N64,
yeah.
you know, and try and make it viable as a platform that way. And of course, Mario is going to be the guy that you're going to go to for that,
right.
you know, because he's their strongest brand. He's their icon. So, I mean, they were always going to put him in that game, even if it was quite a bit different from the side-scrolling ones.
It also lays a blueprint for future games that were going to follow up on that mode. Now, granted, nobody really did. I mean, other people tried to kind of crib that format, but nobody really got around to it till Rare came through. But it at least, even for Nintendo's own internal development teams, it gave them sort of focus on how they're going to handle a 3D world. And that was a bridge they needed to cross early, otherwise games were going to be staggered or damaged in their development cycle having to invent this wheel. It better that they do it at the very beginning and just get it over with.
Yeah,
I think it's very understandable that's what they came out with. And so if there were ever going to be a 2D Mario on N64, it probably would have come later in its life, like it did with these other systems, you know, with Wii especially, we've already talked about it, would have been a similar situation. So I guess the question is, would it have given the N64 sort of a big boost if you could have come in with that later on? And that's where it's harder to answer. I mean, obviously they did something like Yoshi's Story, they did Kirby, you know, they did games that were essentially 2D, whether they had sprite-based graphics or polygonal graphics. Yeah, they
yep.
did side-scrollers on N64. Those
right.
games existed. So, you know, had you put a Mario side-scroller on there, what sort of impact would that have made?
But, I mean, at the time, though, I think the DS and the Wii themselves, they kind of paved the way for this whole throwback gaming.
Well,
it's become a lot more chic than it was in the days of the N64 to play 8-bit games. Like games like Cave Story. You wouldn't see games like that being made back in 1996.
So what you say is the sort of cyclical element that,
exactly.
that, you know, maybe in the 16-bit era, platformers had got so kind of played out that,
yep.
you know, there was this movement against them with 3D that it, had Nintendo put something like Mario out there as a side-scroller, the ceiling for it might only have been a bit more successful than stuff like Yoshi and Kirby.
Yeah, well,
right.
now I would say it's come back around to the point where 3D platformers are kind of seen as being played out.
Well, I would say it's already gotten past that point. I would say we're almost back to the revival phase, because think about what 3D platformers have been this generation.
Mm-hmm.
They've either been hybridized out, where the platforming elements have been greatly reduced, or they've been Mario Galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much it. That's the torchbearer for the 3D platformer right now.
Yep.
Absolutely. There's not many Galaxy clones you could speak about.
I would say the 2D platformer really got kind of burned through in the last few years, because not only has Nintendo pumped out 4 of the fuckers, there's been a ton of games in the download space that have done.
Yeah, and there's more coming. You have the Rayman game from Ubisoft that's coming this year. That's another.
No more Rayman, please.
Multiplayer
please, no
side scroller, you know, that's not just Nintendo. It's kind of spread to other companies at this point. Obviously, the multiplayer spin is kind of in now because of New Super
right.
Mario Bros. Wii as well. It's something a bit different to put on the sort of side scroller. But now, let's talk about the GameCube a bit, because Once you get to GameCube, you've put a bit more distance between yourself and, you know, the real apex of the 2D platform. It's not as played out as it was maybe at the end of the 16-bit era. You've already done 3D. That's already proven. You know, if they'd had the slightly contrarian sort of thing, so instead of doing Sunshine, let's go back to what was really successful for us. Could that have been a time where they would have succeeded with it?
I don't see where they would have made that call, because Mario 64 was successful for them.
Well, it was successful in the context of the system. Obviously, it's one of the biggest sellers for the N64.
To me, they probably looked at its sales numbers as being more constrained by its inability to move hardware. And if that were the case, they would probably say, well, we could make what essentially is Mario 64-2 and put a new spin on it, and its sales should, and ultimately did, track with the hardware we put out. I don't think that there was a much higher ceiling on sales for those two games based on the hardware platform they were on. Now, if your contention is that putting on a 2D game would move hardware, I don't see it, because first off, a 2D platformer on the GameCube controller sucks. I know this. I've done it. It doesn't.
Yeah, it did have a terrible D-pad.
Well, I mean, if they had had a different approach from the very beginning, they might not have actually had a control pad.
They would have been in an even worse position in terms of third-party games if they had said, oh, let's be contrarian about this shit. Yeah, we're going retro on your ass.
Well, I mean, you know, they took a lot of crap for that when they did it with the Wii and even with the DS for being contrarian or not being up to speed with, and ultimately, you know, it paid off. So, I mean, is it unthinkable that they could have made that same switch earlier than they did?
The Wii paid off because of the motion controls. Period. Yeah. End of discussion. The DS paid off because it was the handheld system du jour and won. And essentially, Nintendo said, look, we're not going to make a big, dumb, expensive handheld system. We're going to make a game that's a system that's easy to develop for and is inexpensive, relatively speaking. And we're going to put touchscreen on it just to see what we can do, essentially. I mean, the DS was successful because it won its generation again. Its success is augmented by the new interface it gave, but ultimately the handheld space was very lucrative and Nintendo was in the position to exploit that.
Well, I mean, I think the nature of what they did with the touchscreen and some of the software that they had, I think there's more positive to say about what the DS did, where you seem to be basically say, well, they did do things wrong, like Sony did. I mean, I think there's a lot more that they did right with the DS.
Yeah, but I mean, ultimately, that system would have been successful without Nintendogs still, because they still...
Well, I mean, they would have been... You could take any individual one out. I mean, you can take New Super Mario Brothers out, or you could take Nintendogs, or you could take Animal Crossing, or you could take Brain Age, but it's all of them together that made it as big as it was, because they do appeal to different people. It brings a whole bunch of people in that wouldn't necessarily go together, but then after a while, they try other things as well.
I think of that list, though, Animal Crossing and New Super Mario Brothers are the least significant, which may seem weird because New Super Mario Brothers sold more than those games, but it sold to people who owned the system.
And Animal Crossing as well is massive in Japan, like, you know, ridiculous. Right. So, I mean, those are two of the biggest sellers. But basically, your point is that these 2D games on the system, they've cleaned up on the basis of success that's already been established, and then they've added to it as well. But they're not causal in that way.
No, and the reason, as far as I see it, the 3D games don't sell, there's a nostalgia element to it. So you could say, well, maybe Nintendo could trade on that nostalgia and make another new Super Mario Bros. Game, but they're already making one.
I think we've concentrated on the console space, but I think one of the things that was always astonishing to me was the fact that once you got to the GBA, they only did the remakes.
Right.
That I always found really kind of shocking. I mean, I guess, you know, it was lucrative for them. You know, they had these
It was certainly easy.
They were low cost, and they got a bloody good return out of them. But it was always surprising to me because, of course, they had original games on the Game Boy, you know, the Super Mario Lands 1 and 2, and then that sort of segued into the Wario Land series and all that. It's very odd to me that they just completely sort of sidestepped that on the GBA. I think that's way harder to understand in a way than the console stuff because, of course, you know, you didn't have this whole 3D, is 2D obsolete question, or, you know, the handhelds, it was always there. That's what they were.
Well, you know, I think to a certain degree that may have been that they just didn't think that they could do something new enough or different enough. It sounds kind of strange, but...
So they're going to do literally the exact same thing.
Yeah, but see, now, the thing is, again, now, in this time period, that is kind of new, and that sets itself apart.
Yeah, that's the cyclical element again. Yeah. At this point, you can sort of do something like New Super Mario Bros., which is pretty conservative.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, you add multiplayer. That's a pretty big deal with the Wii game. But, yep. You know, these games are not trying to reinvent the Mario formula, far from it. They're trying to represent it to the audience of today, and yeah. Also, you know, spark that nostalgia. So maybe, you know, it had to wait the number of years that it did to catch fire in the same way that it did. I mean, I think there's an argument for that. Now, whether Nintendo kind of keenly sensed that and bided their time and thought, no, it's too soon, it's too soon, okay, do it now. I doubt it. I think it's
I don't know. I don't entirely know about that, because they would have said, okay, well, how old were the people that were playing, you know, these games when they first came out? Like the old 8-bit games. Okay, how old are they now? Oh, they're in their, like, you know, 30s or, you know, whatever. Oh, they probably have kids and they probably have a Wii. You know?
I think it may go into it, but it's interesting because you look at some series that Nintendo has, sort of very big commercial series, and they are quite happy to just keep hitting it on every single system. Mario Kart's a good example. Animal Crossing has become a good example, where, you know, the games are much the same
right
every time, and they're just like, well, we gotta have one for this system, here it is, and, you know, they've got no compunctions about putting it out in much the same way, and it makes them money. But for some reason, they're not quite happy to do that with Mario, or they weren't anyway. Maybe they are now a lot more with, you know, the way that New Super Mario Brothers, you know, showed up on Wii and DS, looks like it's going to show up on Wii U with this.
And the Wii U game is so similar to the Wii game that it's kind of, from what we've seen, it's kind of sad.
Yeah, maybe that will change.
When I was playing it at E3, if you told me it was just an up-resed version of the Wii and it's just a level I never found, I would have believed you.
Yeah, I mean, people have said that. Certainly from what I've seen, I can understand. You know, maybe that's the thing. Maybe now, you know, with what's happened with New Super Mario and stuff, maybe it will be sort of more commoditized in that way. But I think the 3D Mario point is interesting here in terms of there's choice for what to do on 3DS, because you could say, well, you know, is this decision that they've made to go with a more 3D-like game, even though it's, you know, more similar to the side-scrollers, going to haunt them? Because right now they could really use with the more bankable game than with the Strand that struggled to sell as well.
Right.
I think it's one of these things where, for me, Nintendo, I think they believe in 3D Mario, if you know what I mean. Like, they think this is great. It's different from the 2Ds, but people should love it as much.
Right.
And they keep trying to kind of, well, if we do this to it, then people will get it. And it'll sell, you know, almost as much as the 2D Marios. You know, like, they're trying to get, they keep making the, yeah, you know, with Sunshine, I think the way they tried to do it was like, okay, we'll give you the water pack, makes it a lot easier to move around
right.
in normal situations. And then they put the crazy platforming situations in that were different.
Yeah.
And then Galaxy, they made it more linear.
Galaxy 2, they made it even more linear.
Yeah, significantly more, and they changed the hub and all that to make it look more like a new Super Mario Brothers game or something. And then, of course, we get to this Super Mario 3D Land, which is, you know, flagpoles and the whole caboodle.
Right.
So I think they think one day people are going to get it, you know, and it's like 3D Mario is awesome and it'll have an appeal comparable to 2D Mario. And I'm not convinced we'll ever get there, frankly. I mean, I love the 3D Mario games, especially the Galaxy games, much like Shaman says in his letter. You know, the Galaxy 2 is absolutely fantastic. But I just, because of the way it's in 3D, you know, because of some of these issues that Miyamoto himself has talked about with, like, perspective and all this kind of...
Yep.
It's not as accessible. It's not as instant as the 2D games.
Yep.
And it never will be. And I certainly don't think stereoscopic 3D is going to fix that.
I don't want it to be as instant as the 2D games. I actually, I mean, like I said, I wasn't very enamored with New Super Mario Bros. Wii. I found it to be not shallow, but not as deep or compelling as the Galaxy games. And generally speaking, they're inferior games. I mean, they just are.
Well, I think too, you have to remember that I think Nintendo kind of backed off on the whole, or probably backed off is the wrong term, realized that they could make money in games that weren't as deep.
Right.
right? Like, the Wii changed that. Like, they were like, oh my God, like, not everybody is looking for the depth of something like, you know, of our 3D Mario games.
But see, I think internally they still want to make those games.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think Nintendo as a company wants to have their cake and eat it too, obviously, right?
Right.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, they have now, and I think this is, you know, great that they can seem to exist alongside each other. And even now we've got this weird hybrid thing on 3DS, arguably. But, I mean, the only downside I see of that is maybe it makes them extra conservative with the new Super Mario Brothers games, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, if that's their shtick, is being just like the old games.
Can you call them new Super Mario Brothers at that point, though, if they're just the same game with new levels?
Same Super Mario Brothers.
Old Super Mario Brothers Wii.
I would like to see a game that is strictly 2D and all that, but just a bit more progressive, you know? That would be nice, but maybe that's difficult.
Yeah. Yeah.
The 3D ones are the progressive ones, and then the others are the classics.
Yeah, the penguin suit doesn't cut it. That's not sufficient.
I like that power up.
That's not sufficient to show that, yes, you have progressed. You added a power up.
I mean, you know, I'm glad they exist alongside each other now. That's the main thing. And yeah. I have no doubt that we're going to see 2D Mario represented on absolutely everything they put out now.
Sure.
They've learned that it is... Yeah, there is the cyclical stuff, and I hear you on that. I think that's important. And maybe even at some point, you know, that'll come back around, and, you know, 2D platformers will go on another vacation for a little while. But I do think that they now appreciate that there is a certain appeal of this old style that is completely specific to it, and it will never be rendered obsolete.
Yeah,
right.
Like, people will always go on liking that style of game because it is just such a great formula.
Yeah, I mean, Greg, I think you're also right, though, when you were saying that, you know, that for a while there, I'm pretty sure Nintendo was like, well, you know, 3D is the way to go. This is the way it has to be. This is what people want. And I think it took them a while to finally realize that there's more than one audience out there for Mario games.
Yeah, I mean, some of that, I think, goes down to the arms race as well. You know, them and Sony and Sega at the time.
Especially during GameCube, for sure.
Right.
Yeah, but you had the three-way arms race with Xbox and PlayStation 2 as well. In those days, I think, especially in the early days of 3D, there was this big sort of dick-waving contest of, like, our 3D's better, it's more revolutionary, this is real 3D, you know, this is real 3D gameplay. You know, you had Sony did weird stuff, like, they basically, like, a bunch of games that were 2D in Japan, they wouldn't let come out in America, because it kind of like Star Fox 2 syndrome, you know, but in the other direction.
Right, but it was much more institutionalized.
There was this whole view of kind of, you know, a unidirectional view.
Yeah.
Of the development of games, of like 3D, this is it. And everyone got caught up competing with each other. And so what that created was a kind of groupthink.
You ended up with games like Busby, because developers who had no business making 3D games felt they had to make 3D games.
Yep.
So I don't think it's any coincidence that when Nintendo dropped out of that kind of arms race, you know, but technologically, all that kind of stuff, you know, they decided, no, we're really going to go our own way. I mean, they've always gone their own way to a greater or lesser extent, you know, cartridges. We've talked about that already. Mm-hmm. But when they said, you know, we don't need to keep up with the, you know, the HD and all that, it's telling that at that point, they started doing the 2D Marios again. And that's great. That's absolutely my favorite thing that's come out of this generation.
So, I know we need to wrap this question up, but I have 2 points that I'm surprised we haven't made that I should make real quickly.
Yep.
One, I think it's for the same reason putting Mario 64 out on the N64 was important. I think it's important for Nintendo to put out new Super Mario Brothers Land 3D, etc., 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 because it can show that 3DS is capable of doing these sorts of 3D platformer games that you didn't really see much on the NES. I mean, you saw Mario 64, but Nintendo didn't really go in that way again on that handheld. So I think for them, they can establish this is what the system is capable of. It is capable of playing a fully modern style game, not unlike the ones that we published to great acclaim on the Wii. But I think more importantly, New Super Mario Brothers on the DS is still selling well. There's no reason for them to put out another one. They could be like, just keep buying it, guys. I don't care. Shit. I mean, whatever. It cost them nothing for that game to continue. They could put a little sticker on it. Also plays on your 3DS. They'd probably get a bump in sales.
Well, yeah, I mean, the one thing that's interesting, of course, is, you know, it's undeniable that New Super Mario Bros. Wii adding local multiplayer, that's a big reason to get that game too. You know,
right.
If you had your people in your family had DSs. They enjoy playing it on DS. It's a natural thing to then get it for your Wii and we can all play together. The next one on Wii U, that could be a tougher sell. Because as you said, those games are still selling. They're still popular. It's got to bring something more to the table than just Miis, obviously. But what that's going to be is kind of tough. All right, well, we'll now move on. And John has the next letter.
Harold in New York writes, "Sup, RFN, we all know about one famous blue guy that we all know and love who isn't Sonic, our main man, Mega Man. Capcom is screwing us over when it comes to Mega Man. Either that or this
Mega
generation
Man.
Of gamers just aren't interested in timeless classics. Why do you guys think Capcom doesn't support Mega Man as much anymore? Many people requested he be in Marvel vs. Capcom 3 and Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom 3, but no dice. Same thing with the localization for Mega Man Battle Network, Operation Shooting Star for the Nintendo DS, and now with Legends 3 dying. Also, what do you think Capcom should do with the Megster to make a Super Ultimate Grand Return that's fresh, P-H-R-E-S-H, and Mega?
Kill me now."
Well, James, you're our most rabid Mega Man fan on the show, so would you like to field this one to begin?
So, as far as the Battle Network localization, you don't need another Battle Network game. You don't. Look, Harold, I know you think you do. Take my word for it. You don't need another one. You're good. Now, Legends 3, as I pointed out last week, I was still in mourning. I've taken the veil off all the mirrors, but it's still a depressing situation over here. The fortress is still feels empty inside. But MVC3, I think Capcom did this with some other characters, I believe. They basically said, all right, people who have been in all the Marvel vs. Capcom iterations, we're going to take some of them out and replace them with some more obscure characters. I think for them, they felt like, well, if we want this game to continue to be the crazy clusterfuck that it is, even more so than Brawl, but still be, you know, this kind of tight arcade fighter, we need to mix it up and take out some of the things that have been the norms for the series so far.
Yeah.
In the specific case of Mega Man, Ryota Nitsuma, who was the leader of this project, took out Mega Man and replaced him with Zero because he felt there was more variety in what Zero is capable of doing as a fighter. I fully expect that Mega Man will be added back at some point to the MVC franchise, but for the time being, they went and put somebody else that was a little bit different in there. I don't necessarily see the harm in that. I don't think it's a slight to Mega Man because
the point is it's just something that kind of was specific to that game. It's not symptomatic of some broader thing of like Capcom is giving up on Mega Man.
They aren't I mean, if that was the case, they sure as shit wouldn't have put Zero in.
Yeah, if he's still from the franchise.
If they put Axel in, I could say, oh, they really are trying to kill the franchise. They want everyone to hate Mega Man. But they put in Zero, who, yes, Zero is male. But beyond that, Zero is very much a product of the 90s character design. So, yeah, he's got stupid hair and just everything. But he's not totally irredeemable as a character, assuming he's not talking.
I mean, I guess it's kind of forgivable to think, you know, that there's something odd going on with Capcom and Mega Man for a number of reasons. First of all, I mean, Legends isn't the only thing that got cancelled. There was
no.
The Mega Man Universe thing, which would kind of like create your own levels, and it had that weird like animated trailer for it, you know, with Ryu coming in there and all.
It was bizarre, like the claymation thing. It was nuts.
It was weird exactly what they were getting at. But I mean, people who played some of it certainly didn't seem terribly convinced about it. You just didn't seem to get the feel of Mega Man right. So maybe that was just a troubled project in itself rather than anything. But of course, you know, with Inafune's departure, that raises issues. You know, he basically got tired of hitting his head on the glass ceiling of the Capcom corporate structure and decided to strike out on his own. So he's gone. You know, maybe that's an advocate for Mega Man that's kind of gone with it within the company. It's difficult to see where they'll go next.
He really was an avatar for the character. I mean, an advocate for the character. I mean, I know that he was pushing the Mega Man Legends bandwagon hard. And he would make no bones about during interviews. Somebody asked about I'd like to make one if you all make it clear you're receptive to it. Now, what we've been told by Capcom is that Legends 3 was always kind of in this perpetual, like, are we really going to commit resources to make it stage?
Not really greenlit, but they're doing a hell of a lot of stuff.
they were mostly doing PR stuff. Like they wanted to gauge the public response. And at least this is what they say. They wanted to gauge the public response to the game, and they're massive. I mean,
it's some hilarious stuff. Like, I remember seeing a video. I think this was on the Japan Nintendo channel, I'm not exactly sure. A video of, you know, Capcom developers actually playing the Mega Man Legends 3 prototype version.
That we'll never get to play?
We're scheduled to come out with the eShop itself. And so that's what this video was about. It was like, eShop's coming soon, this is going to be one of the things first on it, here's the, you know, some guys playing it, and all, you know, I mean, they're playing the damn thing. And then a couple of weeks later, it misses the eShop launch, and then a month or so after that, the whole thing's canned.
I suspect the resources devoted to it were not sufficient for what that project demanded. Mm. And with Inafune's departure, because I mean, even though he wasn't entirely private about his frustrations with the company.
No, I mean, he was very public about a lot of frustration with Japan gaming in general and Capcom specifically.
And very uncharacteristic for that particular, for Japan.
Yeah, he sounded like he wanted out quite a while before he actually got out.
And then went to found not one, but two different companies because he's a baller.
Like a boss.
Like a double boss. He owns two companies now.
We've come to this point now where Mega Man's got this uncertain future, but I mean, where would you want it to go, James? Just...
Well, I mean, remember that it was not that long ago they put out Mega Man 8 and 9. Or 9 and 10.
9 and 10, yeah.
It's not like they have completely neglected the
franchise.
Well,
I mean, we talked about it before, didn't they? They already kind of did one rethink about what they were doing with the series. You know, they were doing the Zero games for GBA every year or so. They did ZX and ZX Advent for DS. Then they stopped and said, right, now let's go back, do digital stores. We're going to do 9 and 10. And so, you know, there's no say that avenue is killed at all. It seems like it went well, but where do you go from there? I mean, you don't see them just continually putting out 8-bit Mega Man games.
I think what happened with the two 8-bit games was they looked back at what they did on the GBA, specifically Mega Man Battle Network, and said, we monetized the hell out of that. We went double Activision on this series. I mean, remember, they were at one point they were putting out color versions.
Yeah, Pokemon style.
It was like blue and white every year. I mean, you can't do that. That's not good for your franchise. And ultimately, I think it's very Guitar Hero-esque. You push this thing so hard, it's going to break. And I think Capcom is historically very guilty of this. They are the ultimate sequel-making company.
I mean, it's interesting, you know, with Capcom, because, I mean, there's almost a kind of similar, there's a parallel to the previous question we talked about with Mario, like with Street Fighter. You know, you could argue, why did Street Fighter 4 take so long to happen? That seems like a really obvious thing. It's basically just a Street Fighter 2 revival. Everybody loved that. They went in weird places with like Alpha and 3 was different and all this kind of stuff. Why not just bring back the thing that people loved, which is basically what they did with 4? And yet it took them a very long time to get to that point. And now guess what? You know, the fighting genre is sort of back in business in a big way. I mean, it's just that again suggests a cyclical component, I think. That it was just their time again.
Right. And I would point out, though, that Yoshinori Ono sort of took over the Street Fighter franchise, and that might have as much to do with Street Fighter 4 being made as anything.
Right, so it was a question of the right guy getting his hands on the controls at the right time.
Yeah, somebody having enough pull.
But with Mega Man, I'm a recent convert to Mega Man, but I've played now, you know, a number of the 8-bit games. I've played X, I've played ZX Advent. You know, I like all of them, so I want to see more Mega Man. I mean, I think probably what may well happen and what I would be fine with happening is they do a new Mega Man X game for digital.
Right.
Do the 16-bit revival, you know. It's getting to be quite a few years since they first did 9, so if we keep hammering this whole cyclical theme, the 16-bit era is ripe for a revisit, I think, you know, maybe a year down the line or something.
Yep.
And then in the meantime, maybe they can figure out what they want to do with the series in the sort of post-Inafune world.
Bamboo Pandemonium.
Not that. just they could what they want to do is a bit more, you know, pushing out, you know, that might actually be a new full price game, maybe for 3DS or Vita or, you know, the consoles, whatever. That maybe that's what they need, is just some more time to kind of figure it out, and you can keep the digital stuff going to keep Mega Man alive in the interim.
As long as they keep my IV drip of Shu Takumi games going, I'll be okay. if they turn off the spigot on that, shit is gonna hit the fan.
Well, you got the Leighton crossover. Well, I certainly hope that's going
to... I hope we'd better get that game. I mean...
Over here, yeah. Well, yep. You think so, because Leighton, unlike, you know, some of the Capcom games, is big business, especially in Europe.
Right, and the Phoenix Wright games didn't do terrible. It's just that the Edgeworth game just didn't... I mean, they did probably burn that series a little hard.
Well, we have now the final email of the show, and this is pretty much especially for James, so I'll read it for him.
Okay.
Skytar writes, Mario Kart 7, I believe, is the greatest name for any Mario game. These are some of the reasons why.
So, Greg, I'm going to stop you after each point because I have responses for each.
Okay, we're going to sequentially alternate. Okay. So, number one. Because it goes off the track of Super Mario Kart for Super Nintendo 64 for N64, DS for Mario Kart DS, and Wii for Mario Kart Wii. It's so amazing that they've gone on a numbering streak. It's so monotonous that it's genius.
This point is difficult for me because
it seems to me to basically say it's so bad it's good. I think is so, that's yeah, what I'm getting.
I'm sure I'm missing it in some kind of ironic hipsterish way, like spending hours crafting a hobo beard. But I don't get how tacking a number onto an entry is creative. I call it counting. Making this action as creative as the bare minimum for getting out of kindergarten. I'd also point out that monotony is really only genius when it's got some kind of deeper meaning. Usually that's to illustrate the subject itself is monotonous, which is not exactly the image you'd want to convey in a Mario Kart game.
I'd also say that, in fact, them slavishly naming each one after the system it was on was monotonous, and so they've broken the monotony. So if you're in the monotony game, this is a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, I've... But beyond that, I've used monotony in a review, in the structure of a review's text, to sort of supplement my saying the game is unpleasantly monotonous.
Reinforcing the point.
Right, so like I used a bunch of short, similarly structured sentences in a row to make a point. Now, I'm not sure you want to be kept in the same company I put Dungeon Explorer, but hey, if you're going for monotony, knock yourself out.
I'm just amazed that I can be called an ironic hipster by playing Mario Kart Wii.
There you go. Because John,
you're that if you just stroke your beard looking at the cover art for Mario Kart 7, go brilliant, brilliant.
I need to cut like a place like I messed up with the razor right here, so people think I don't care.
I can't be bothered to shave properly. That's just how cool I am.
That's right.
Number two. The one that was not named after a console before, Mario Kart Double Dash, changed up the formula of the racing, so that made it fun and interesting. Thus, it was my favourite one. Personal side note, the two people racing in the same car was pure genius, and I wish the Wii one was like that. So by not calling it by its console name, it gives us some insight and intrigue that this game might be different from the other by-the-book Mario Kart games.
I'd point out that Mario Kart for the 3DS's primary change to change to the formula is looking at cheat sheets from Diddy Kong Racing.
Well, to be fair, it's a bit different because don't forget, those were completely separate. So
true.
You choose, whereas this is like in the same race, you will fly and then you'll go underwater. It's not separate vehicles.
They're borrowing a little bit here, but I would say the Double Dash, this is not. I mean...
No, it's not. I mean, I think Double Dash really... I mean, not. Of course it can be done on a handheld, but that makes more sense in the context of a console Mario Kart
right,
game.
But I mean, in terms of the amount of changing up the formula they're doing, this is not Double Dash levels of formula changing.
And we still haven't seen all the aspects of it. I mean, how important is this customization thing? It could be completely trivial, or who knows, it could actually be more important than you think, considering you do have these different modes where you're gliding or you're underwater. You know, maybe how you construct your kart is actually going to matter more because it's, you know, like, well, you've constructed something that you love driving, but it really sucks in the air or something.
Right, but that's not exactly revolutionary either. I mean, No. The F-Zero GameCube games did that. And it's not as if their only option would have been to call it Mario Kart 3DS. Clearly Mario 3D Kart was on the table.
Yeah, we've seen that with the 3D Land.
So, I mean, brand synchronicity could have been the power play here.
And the other thing I would point out is that Super Circuit for GBA is also kind of an exception to the whole naming.
Yes, it is. And Super Circuit is very conservative.
In Japan, I think it was just called Advance, though. So if you're going by Japanese naming, maybe that doesn't count. But, you know, on the Double Dash point, briefly, I think that idea would be great if you did it on Wii U, where, like, one of the guys is holding the tablet controller, and, like, he's the guy in the back, so he's actually got, like,
he can see behind the cart, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got a rear view, so, like, and he's aiming, like, shells and stuff and bananas at the people behind you, and so it would be way more involved kind of supplementary player. That could be great.
Yep.
And we'll get to that with point three.
Okay, point three then. By numbering it Mario Kart 7, just like Johnny said in the last episode, it gives them another chance to make another Mario Kart game on the same console, instead of just limiting them to one game only. It was a genius move on Nintendo's
genius
part.
Genius. All around.
Is getting another episode of Mario Kart really a necessity? Is the world crying out for an unimpeded flow of carts and racing?
No, I mean, what they want to happen is what's happened on Wii and DS. They put it out in 2005 and it's still selling in 2010. They don't want to put another one out.
No, it's not as if the world doesn't know Mario Kart is coming. I mean, for God's sakes, that game is going to happen. It's not like I just superseded Nintendo's announcements from E3. I'm not getting blackballed from their next press event for announcing this. Everybody knows there's going to be a Mario Kart U.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody's saying, God, this is the last Mario Kart game I'll ever get because they put 3DS on there.
So to close out, this is what Skytar says. I know James doesn't quite agree with numbering them at 7 first, but it throws an interesting wrench into the unimaginative naming of these great titles. And don't we all know Nintendo likes to surprise us all with quirks, i.e. the now devaluization of my 3DS at the cost of 20 free games. It was like waking up from a terrible nightmare.
So in response to his fourth point, which he possibly ironically didn't number... I'm not sure I'm going to call counting as throwing a monkey wrench into naming conventions. The only way this is unconventional is that the count is wrong. This is Mario Kart number 9.
Yeah, I would not include those arcade games.
Well, no, you have to include the arcade games.
They don't play like Mario Kart. They're just wrong.
Look, it doesn't matter because there's a few ways you can say they don't count. But I'd point out that while they are Namco developed, they still do count. And I could prove this but two different ways. One, it was developed at Nintendo's behest, so you can't use its parentage to discredit it. It's numbering unless you also take issue with the non-Nintendo-developed Luigi's Mansion 2. You also argue that you can't disqualify it for being a, quote, arcade game and not on a Nintendo system, because Arcade GX and its sequel were developed for the Triforce, which is a GameCube-based arcade system developed by Nintendo in conjunction with arcade veterans Sega and Namco.
Yeah, that was the Triforce, the three of them.
Donkey Kong 3, the game Donkey Kong 3, premiered on the arcade, and its numbering carried over to its console releases. So, clearly, Nintendo doesn't mind counting arcade games.
And in terms of, you know, I think the deal breaker here, in terms of why Nintendo started numbering, it's no coincidence that Windows 7, that happened as well. It's just 7's a cool number. It sounds cool. It's got lucky connotations in a lot of cultures. So, there is not going to be a Mario Kart 8.
Look, somewhere there is a culture where 7 is a fucking curse, and Nintendo just screwed them.
Mario Kart 8's a pretty cool number, too.
I don't know.
It's like a figure eight. There, bang!
Don't,
they should have counted
slide
eight.
You could make some. You could make a cool.
They can make. They can make like a track design for the eight. It could be great.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
There has been a figure eight track in. I think this is the first track in Mario Kart DS.
Yeah, but I want to make a couple final points before I wrap up. While the arcade games are called arcade, they are actually for the Triforce system. So if we accept the argument that only Double Dash isn't named after the console games, noting that the GBA game in Japan is actually named Advanced, they would need to be called Mario Kart Triforce GX, which would be quite an interesting crossover.
That would be awesome. That's what you actually get given on the podium.
There you go.
Like,
it's
instead
the Triforce.
Of like the flower cup, it's the Triforce.
And I would also like to say, with the failure of counting in play here, it's pretty much Rambo-esque, where you have First Blood, then Rambo First Blood Part 2, and then Rambo 3, and then Rambo. Yes. This is Sly Country, and your population is Cobra. And that is not a population you want, because you're going to be shot in the head.
Well, that completely necessary discussion about Mario Kart's naming is going to wrap up the show for this week. So thanks very much to everyone who wrote in. We will be handling more of your listener mail next week, so keep them coming in to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And so now we end the show with our customary lineup of plugs. So, of course, the newscasts every week. Most recently, at the time of this recording, they hit episode 64. So, appropriately, they talked about the N64, which, of course, is something that we still haven't done. We three, we got left out. We are literally the only people left that haven't done an N64 special.
Because
at this point.
We were left out, you fuckers!
It still burns.
It does. And you know what? That's why we recorded the supplement. That's why it's there. If you haven't heard it, go find the N64 episode, because we have a nice little commentary at the end as to why we were left out and replaced it with a much better episode.
Evidently, we haven't let it go. But everyone else who wants their N64 nostalgia fulfilled should surely enjoy that episode of the newscast. Radio Trivia, of course, still ongoing. I'm not sure about another episode beyond the one that I did, but keep your eyes peeled. I'm sure there'll be one not long now until it gets up to episode 100 in the storied history of Radio Trivia podcast edition. And, of course, there's everything that's going on at crosstalk.com. Carl, the purveyor of that, has got many podcasts there. And, of course, Johnny is by far the most prolific of his umbrella of podcasts with the Discover Music Project. And, of course, we are still planning to discuss Killer 7 in our retroactive feature a couple of weeks from now, actually. So I am pretty much ready after some significant trouble and set up to play the game. John's had a copy lying around forever. Mm-hmm. Apparently, so he's finally going to actually bother
of
to
course.
Play it. James has already got some pretty solid opinions on the merits and otherwise of the game, but he'll be replaying it too, so we'd very much advise you to dig out your copy if you've got one already, or maybe if you can find one cheap, play along.
Also, if you voted for this game, you'd better fucking play it.
Yeah, we want buy-in. Your old stakeholders, you've got to...
I will find you. John didn't miss last week because of work. Let's put it that way.
That's right.
John missed last week because he was in traction.
That's why I found my copy.
Was in the hospital. Was it in the hospital bed?
Yep.
James is actually the inspiration for the TV show Dog the Bounty Hunter. Perhaps you've seen it.
Except I don't use bear mace. Let's be
no,
clear.
No, but I mean the hair and the suntan and everything is pretty much exactly the same.
And the steroid usage.
Yep.
So, yeah, we'll be playing that in a couple of weeks, so I hope you'll be able to join in. The discussion is already open at the forums in the podcast discussion section of them. I'm sure it's going to get pretty spirited, given the quite polarizing nature of Killer 7. And so, that is it. Thanks to James and John, of course, and to Johnny, who left us earlier on.
Bastard.
And we will see you next week. Bye-bye, everybody.
Later.
Bye.
Well, it's actually a different question. James, will you be more or less incensed if they keep numbering them from now on?
I will be perpetually irritated.
Well, either way, which is more irritating?
I would, unless they pull a Square Enix and retcon two numbers out of the counting to take out for the arcade games, I will be equally irritated each time. If they do that, I will be so shocked at the sheer audacity of their total lack of counting that I'll be like, you know what? Nice work.
I had no idea you felt so strongly about these arcade games. Really.
Yeah,
look,
well-formulated responses all around.
It's not that I feel particularly strongly about the games, but it's if you're going to randomly...
I played it, I did not enjoy it.
It's that if you're going to randomly start counting shit, you should at least do it correctly.
Maybe they did this numbering for the express purpose of indicating that the arcade games don't count.
They're
it's
not
like,
canon.
Well,
they're not
yeah, if
canon.
If we say 7, you know which two we're getting rid of.
That's right.
It's not 64 and Super Mario Kart, hint.
Well, maybe they really, really, really hate Double Dash. I mean, maybe they're just like, you know, Having Luigi on the back of Waluigi's cart is like a bacchanalian orgy of crazy.
I think Double Dash, you know, whatever its status or infamous IGN reviews or whatever, it probably made quite a lot more money for them than those arcade games.
Well, that's not saying much.